Yesterday, the long-running congressional battle over privacy and surveillance ended. The Senate voted to curb the collection of millions of Americans' phone records, and the president signed it into law. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'm joined this Politics Wednesday by Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. We'll talk about the significance of the NSA surveillance overhaul. Also this hour, Bernie Sanders and the appeal of progressive fighters. But where does this leave Hillary Clinton? Lindsey Graham officially joins the battle for the Republican presidential nomination, and the Iowa legislative session draws to a close. Politics Day with Chris Larimer and Dennis Goldford. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has once again arrived, and we are so glad to have Chris Larimer with us of the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio and on the faculty there at the University of Iowa. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben.
Chris is Associate Professor of Political Science at UNI. Dennis Goldford in our Des Moines studio. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Professor of Political Science and the Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Dennis, thank you for coming in. Lots to tackle this hour. I'm eager to hear both of your insights on what we're experiencing as we are inside, I believe, the eight-month mark heading up to the caucuses. I know they have apps for this. I'm going to get an hourly countdown to the caucuses. That's supposing it stays to be February 1st, but Dennis, we know those things can move.
Oh, sure. They bounce around all over the place.
Later in the program, we want to talk about Bernie Sanders and the unexpected appeal he seems to have here in Iowa and where that leaves Hillary Clinton. Lindsey Graham officially joining the battle for the Republican presidential nomination as well. But first, let's tackle this gentleman and back to Bernie Sanders. We want to reach out to you, our listeners, before I forget. Because Bernie Sanders has been filling the halls here, the venues where he's appeared, he's striking some sort of chord with Iowans. And we want to reach out to you. Does Bernie Sanders' message strike a chord with you? In six words or less, describe what his politics mean to you via our social media would be great. Our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Perhaps you've been to a Bernie Sanders rally. Tell us about it. 1-866-780-9100. That coming up in just a moment. Before that, yesterday, the long-running congressional battle over privacy and surveillance ended. The Senate voted to curb the collection of millions of Americans' phone records. The president signed it into law last night, and it marks the first significant retrenchment of government surveillance powers since the 9/11 attacks. It's a new law known as the USA Freedom Act, reauthorizing and rebooting the provisions of the U.S. Patriot Act. That lapsed on Sunday at midnight. This one will phase out the National Securities Agency's bulk phone records program. Instead, it will shift the storage of the phone records to telecommunications companies. The significance of this measure, Dennis Goldford?
Well, you know, we've got this problem that we've had since 9/11, that we've returned to a condition in which Americans, with justification, feel themselves under threat from people willing to do them harm. And the old problem has always been, of course, how do you balance security concerns with freedom concerns? And, of course, we hear Rand Paul saying an awful lot about that. But we certainly had a certain reaction to 9/11 and allowed the federal government to do all sorts of things that people on both the right and the left, as opposed to the center, have believed to be an invasion of our privacy. And so there's pushback, at least for now, until we have another, we hope we don't, but if we have another event, anything like 9/11 or close to it, some of that pushback will stop.
Mm-hmm. What was at the heart of the disagreement in getting this done? It took quite a while, a lot of delay in the Senate especially.
Well, again, I'll I'll have trouble parsing that because it became the difference between the Freedom Act and the Patriot Act, and it starts to get into a detail that, frankly, I have difficulty talking about. Chris may be more up to date on that, but it's again the question of what the government is allowed to do with our metadata. In other words, the government is allowed to know, at least has been allowed to know, who we might call. And how long we might talk to that person and where that person might have been located. The government might not know who it is specifically we called or what we said on the message. That's this idea of metadata. But the question is, can the government use that to go snooping around more than it should? The government will argue that if the government has to go to a judge for a warrant in every particular case, they don't have the personnel to do that, and they may not be able to follow leads they need to follow.
Mm-hmm. We can trace this all back to Edward Snowden's 2013 mm-hmm. leaks mm-hmm. about the secretive data collection. Let's listen to a little bit of Edward Snowden. This is, I believe, yesterday reacting to this new bill that was passed into law.
You know, they took our seat away and they closed the doors and they decided that we'll begin making the decisions for you. And while we haven't, you know, won that fight, we have made progress since then in an extraordinary way. Papers around the world have published stories about serious government abuses that were violations of law, that were violations of rights. We've seen courts stand up and strike down these programs as illegal, as unlawful, or never permissible in the first place.
Edward Snowden there. I wonder, Chris, do you think with this step, considering the reaction that he set off, do you think Snowden's actions will now be seen in a different historical perspective? When this all started, we were debating the question, Edward Snowden, hero or traitor?
Yeah, I think there's potentially that case to be made there. But I also think, you know, touching on a little bit of what Dennis mentioned, just the amount of fluctuation in public opinion regarding national security. I mean, right after 9/11, of course, everybody was in favor of the Patriot Act. You had one senator, Senator Russell Feingold from Wisconsin, voting against it, but everybody else was overwhelmingly in favor of it. Now we fast forward, 14 years later, and, you know, national security, the threat of terrorism is roughly, 13-14% as far as the public seeing it as a significant issue. And, we don't have the support for something like the Patriot Act that we did 14 years ago. As Dennis said, if, hopefully it doesn't happen, but if there would be another terrorist attack, you would just see it jump right back up as being kind of the most important problem. But, it's a case where the public hasn't seen a lot of evidence that the Patriot Act is working, other than we know there hasn't been another terrorist attack. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes with some of the surveillance and the extent to which it's actually helped to prevent a terrorist attack. We know there's been an independent study that says the surveillance really hasn't helped in that regard. But beyond that, this is a case where there was a growing disconnect between public policy and public opinion. And I think that's why we saw finally and what Edward Snowden didn't kind of put it over the top for the U.S. Congress to act in this case.
Mm-hmm. Chris Larimer with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Dennis Goldford of Drake University. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we pivot now to talk about the enthusiasm for the candidates, an independent candidate trying to win the Democratic nomination, Bernie Sanders of Vermont. We're asking you, if he strikes a chord with you, in six words or less, describe what his politics mean to you. We've had a lot of reaction to that on our social media. Zade tweets, usually honest and principled despite obstacles. Renee on Facebook, refreshing, real, challenge the status quo. Donald on Facebook, anti-corporatist, fighting big money. Seth says on Facebook as well, bold social democratic principles. Sandra tweeting, we'll get money out of politics. So an unexpected enthusiasm for Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont here in Iowa during his first swing through our state since declaring his candidacy for the Democratic nomination. He was greeted by overflow crowds at most stops. For example, Sanders drew 700 people at an event a few days ago in Davenport. That's the largest rally in the state for any single candidate this campaign season. We've heard stories of Iowans driving miles to see him. not being able to get into the venue because it's already full. Dennis Goldford, what is behind this enthusiasm?
Couple of things. The first is that Hillary Clinton is leaving a vacuum. In other words, there are people that support Hillary Clinton, on the Democratic side at least, because they would like to have a female president for the first time, and they would like her to be the first female president. But other than that, what is, and we've talked about this before, what does she stand for? What does Hillary Clinton mean in terms of a governing philosophy? And she's just not said much of anything. And there's politics, like other things, abhors a vacuum. And Bernie Sanders, who's interesting in his own right, is talking a kind of language that cause-oriented and issue-oriented Democrats are interested in very intensely. So she's creating a kind of vacuum that he's able to fill at the moment.
Okay, let's listen to Bernie Sanders making comments in a Yahoo interview with Katie Couric on Monday, talking about his popularity here in Iowa.
Then we went to Iowa, and it really became crazy. I mean, just huge crowds. And we ended up Sunday morning in Minneapolis. 4,000 people came out. And I think the reason for that is that people are just having enough with the status quo from an economic perspective and a political perspective. They see the rich getting much richer and everybody else hurting, and they want people to start standing up for the middle class.
Bernie Sanders there. Renee says, one of our listeners, in the six words or less to describe the politics of Bernie Sanders, young people are excited about him. Chris Larimer, your read on Bernie Sanders.
Well, I think he's saying what likely caucus goers want to hear. I mean, we know that caucus goers, whether you're talking about Republicans or Democrats, tend to be at the more extreme end of the party. And he's talking about economic inequality. You know, there was a lot of enthusiasm for a potential Elizabeth Warren run because they saw her as a candidate who could who would talk about economic inequality. She's decided presumably not to run. But Bernie Sanders is talking about it, and he's talking about it in a way that excites the party activists, excites people who are likely to show up on caucus night, and that's what they want to hear. As Dennis said, you know, Hillary Clinton's been around for a long time. There's questions about what she wants to do because her campaign to this point has been so controlled. But Bernie Sanders is getting out there. He's firing up the base and talking about issues that Democratic caucus goers want to hear about.
Okay, let's hear some more of Bernie Sanders. These comments coming from April, I think before he declared his candidacy to NBC News in Chicago. Just to chime in with Chris there, you're talking about some of the themes, getting a feeling for this candidate. If you already don't know what Bernie Sanders is about, here's some more of his rhetoric.
But clearly, there needs to be a voice to represent the working families of this country, and that is why I'm giving very serious thought to running for president. What is the progressive movement? That's what you see out there. And I just came back from Austin, where we had as many people. I came back from Los Angeles, San Francisco, huge crowds. It's not about me, and it's not about Elizabeth. Elizabeth's a great senator and a good friend of mine. It is about, can we bring together working people to stand up and take on the billionaire class? Nothing personal about this at all. So Elizabeth and I are good friends.
Okay. It's not about me, and it's not anything against Elizabeth there. Dennis, progressive. He used the word progressive. That's thrown around a lot. He describes himself as a socialist Democrat. Give us some light there in that corner of the Democratic Party.
Right. I think he sees himself as a democratic socialist. And, of course, from the standpoint of most Republicans and conservatives, that's a contradiction in terms. If you're democratic, you can't be a socialist. If you're socialist, it's not democratic. But that's a particular partisan look at that. He caucuses with the Democrats in the Senate, but he's technically there as an independent from Vermont. He was a socialist mayor of Burlington, I believe. He called himself a socialist in the House of Representatives. There was a long tradition of a kind of Native American radicalism. And by Native American, I don't mean Indians. I mean people who were, you know, homegrown. That exists back into the early 19th century, critics of capitalism and inequality and things like that. Eugene Debs, remember, got something like 6 million votes, I think, in the election of 1912, socialist, avowedly socialist candidate. the worst thing that ever happened to this radical tradition in America was the creation of the Soviet Union, because people who were more conservative then could say that, oh, you folks who are offering this radical critique of American capitalism are agents of a foreign power. And so really, since the rise of the Soviet Union, whatever Bernie Sanders' merits or demerits, virtues or vices, if you've got socialism attached to your name, it's going to be really hard to win a major party nomination, let alone to be competitive in a presidential election.
Six words or less, talk about the politics of Bernie Sanders. That's the challenge to our listeners this hour. London tweeting, to me, Bernie Sanders signals a return to common sense in politics. Tom in Fort Dodge offering government back to the people. Those could have been comments actually plugged into pretty much any campaign. Sorry, don't mean to slight you, London and Tom in Fort Dodge. France in Dubuque calling. I understand you've been to see Bernie Sanders in Davenport.
Yes, I have. I went to see him last week. We drove down 50 miles to see him speak.
Mm-hmm. What was the atmosphere like?
Well, the atmosphere was electric, to say the least. He just energized the whole room when he walked in. And I think that's really what Bernie Sanders has going for him. He speaks to left-wing Democrats, which Hillary Clinton just simply doesn't do. You know, he's a socialist, yes, and I think that's what resonates with Democrats at the moment. You know, in the last election, we kind of hid from our principles of socialism and liberalism, and I think in this election, we want to stand up for those principles. And a lot of people say socialism is a bad word. If you look at what Bernie Sanders stands for with socialism, it's the fact that he wants to spread the wealth and he wants to build the middle class. Mm-hmm. I think that's what we stand for.
France, I wonder if you took note at that gathering, young, old, people of diversity, different skin colors. What did you see?
I'm 18, and we had a lot of 18-year-olds there, I think, who just think Bernie Sanders is the right choice. I mean, people from all walks of life were there, old, young, black, white. Just it was a very diverse crowd, I think.
Okay.
Go
ahead, Dennis, you first. And
that's
then Chris,
interesting in what he said, I was going to mention this earlier, that despite the fact that we're talking about younger voters in many cases, younger voters in both parties seem to be attracted to older, if I might say, protest candidates. If you think of Gene McCarthy, you know, Get Clean for Gene back in 1968, he attracted younger voters very much. Ron Paul attracted younger voters as a kind of protest candidate within the Republican Party. And Bernie Sanders is attracting a lot of younger people as well. So it's interesting that younger people for protest aren't going to younger candidates. They're going to these senior citizens, if you will.
Chris Larimer.
Well, I think what will be interesting with the Sanders enthusiasm right now is to see what extent it affects what's going on in Iowa. Right now, you know, he there is a lot of enthusiasm around his candidacy, but nationally, you know, he's still polling 40-plus points behind Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
If he actually starts to move the polls in Iowa, if there's another Iowa poll that comes out in a couple of months and he's actually within, say, 15 points of Hillary Clinton, does Hillary Clinton change her strategy and start talking about different things? Do you start to see sort of more mainstream endorsements for Hillary Clinton from sort of mainstream Democratic, big-name Democratic office holders and what have you, to try to sort of shore up the support because of a fear that a Sanders candidacy could somehow derail Hillary Clinton's path to the nomination and then somehow hurt the Democrats in the long run.
He could be the Democrats' Rand Paul. In other words, the established element of the party gets really nervous on the Republican side at the thought of Rand Paul, and you'd have the established side of the Democratic Party really nervous about somebody like Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. Franz, before we say goodbye to you, Franz in Dubuque, did he win your vote? Will you be caucusing for Bernie Sanders? Can you say that yet?
Well, it's a bit early for that, but the thing about Bernie Sanders that separates him from Marty Amell and Hillary Clinton is that he's talking about the issues, which is something that Hillary Clinton is doing at the moment.
Okay.
I think that's the reason that many people are supporting him.
Okay, you're breaking up a little bit, France and Dubuque, but thank you for your call. What I understood there, France, says Bernie Sanders is talking about the issues and issues that he says Hillary Clinton is not talking about. Bernie Sanders' positions, far higher taxes on the wealthy comes to mind, deep military spending cuts. Any other specific positions either of you can think of that Bernie Sanders stands for?
Well, I think, you know, one of the appeals for younger voters is that he comes off as unscripted. Whereas Hillary Clinton seems at this point to be so managed and so controlled, so worried about saying something that's not going to play well in the press, he he seems to come off as unscripted and just saying what he actually feels.
I think also, though, again, for Democrats, the difficulty is that Republicans and conservatives have said for years that liberals are just socialists in sheep's clothing. And they're not, just as conservatives are not fascists in sheep's clothing. There are significant differences there. But Bernie Sanders could give some validation to that argument that Republicans and conservatives have made for a long time.
Okay. As you mentioned earlier, Chris, so we had the news this week, Run, War, and Run, the campaign to draft her, so to speak, to become a presidential candidate has been suspended. The $1.25 million movement to try to convince her was disbanded on Monday. Let's get a taste of that. I want to play a little bit of Elizabeth Warren and then ask if there's any daylight between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Here's some classic Elizabeth Warren making her comments last week at a conference hosted by the tech website RE Code.
Too many of the people in Washington do not represent the folks who elected them. They represent the rich and the powerful, who don't want their taxes raised, who don't want to see any change, who are perfectly happy with things where they are. Indeed, they're doing great with things where they are. And they stay in the ear of enough of the folks in Washington that it has made it almost impossible to get any kind of change. The only way we get change is when enough people in this country say, I'm mad as hell and I'm fed up and I'm not gonna do this anymore. You are not gonna go back and represent me in Washington, D.C. if you are not willing to pass a meaningful infrastructure bill. If you are not willing to refinance student loan interest rates and stop dragging in billions of dollars in profits off the backs of kids who otherwise can't afford to go to college, if you don't say you're going to fund the NIH and the NISF because that is our future, we have to make these issues salient and not just wonky.
Senator Elizabeth Warren there with the passion. Also, we can hear even anger there. Chris Larimer, is there daylight between Bernie Sanders and Warren?
I'm not sure that there is. At a very general level, I think that their message is almost identical in terms of taking a very progressive stance, really focused on economics, you know, working class Americans, raising the minimum wage, the gap between the rich and the poor. I think, you know, both candidates are pretty much on the same page there. I think it's just that you know, Bernie Sanders, in some sense, sort of beat her to the punch in terms of declaring his candidacy, getting out there, starting to talk about the issues. She has hesitated so much.
Well, she was asked enough times.
Dennis,
before we go to break, this fits into the type of populism that is traditional in American political history.
Well, there's a left-wing and there's a right-wing populism. What's common to both is the idea that the middle class is getting a raw deal, that government, in some sense, is screwing over the middle class. Left-wing populism says government's working for the wealthy and the well-connected and screwing over the middle class. Right-wing populism says government's working for those people below us who are worthless and shiftless and don't really pull their weight in society.
Very interesting. We'll come back with more insights from Dennis Goldford and Chris Larimer, our political analysts on this Politics Wednesday here on River to River. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we discuss the latest on the political landscape. When we come back, we've talked about Bernie Sanders' enthusiasm. What are the implications of this enthusiasm? We breached that a little bit there a few moments ago, but is this something that's bad or perhaps good for the Clinton candidacy? How does it shape the narrative and the race for that Democratic nomination? That's when we get back after a few minutes of break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Dennis Goldford with us for this Politics Wednesday here on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Chris Larimer. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, and Dennis Goldford of Drake University. And you've been joining in with your participation on this Politics Wednesday. We've discussed the enthusiasm, unexpected for most people, the enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders' candidacy. And wanted to finish up that conversation by talking about the implications for the Hillary Clinton campaign. Chris, as you mentioned, we'll see if the apparent enthusiasm on the ground in the form of venues overflowing, people coming from miles around to see Bernie Sanders, perhaps not even getting into the venue. We heard from one person who attended a Bernie Sanders rally in the first half hour. We'll see if that's reflected in rising poll numbers for Bernie Sanders. But Chris, what do you see as the implications for the Clinton campaign if there should be some sort of significant jump in his numbers?
Well, I think there's a significant jump in his numbers and a significant jump in donations going to Sanders. I do think we may start to see a different approach for the Hillary Clinton campaign. And again, she can't hold the type of event necessarily that a Bernie Sanders can, where she can just come out and have sort of a 100 or 200 or even 300 person public event. If Hillary Clinton comes to a small town in Iowa, you know, you probably are looking at 1,000 people coming out for the event. But I do think you will see more unscripted events, more open events, more public events, where she's out there, you know, doing the rope lines, trying to talk to big crowds and trying to get people enthusiastic about her campaign. I think you maybe will see a little bit of a shift in her message. Maybe talking more about, you know, some of the quote progressive issues. She already talks about working class Americans. I think that will continue to be a theme for her campaign, but I think it'll depend on sort of the staying power that the Sanders enthusiasm has.
Dennis Goldford, you wrote the book literally on the Iowa caucuses, but so tell us, you've hammered it into our heads over the years that it's about exceeding expectations,
right?
Not necessarily about winning. So what is the scenario? Bernie Sanders doesn't have to win the caucuses. He has to do what to rattle the Clinton campaign?
You know, if he could show up getting something like 30% to 40% of that state you know, it's so difficult to measure what we get out of the Democrats, of course. But if he should show up with something like 30% or even 40% of caucus support, however we measure that, that would be suggesting a significant challenge to her. But see, this could do two good things for her, following up what Chris said. Number one is she desperately needs competition. She campaigned in 2007 and early 2008 as the candidate of inevitability and fell flat on her face, but she became a better candidate as that campaign proceeded. So she desperately needs competition. She can't be the regal queen waving to the crowds, number one. And number two, if there's a strong challenge from Sanders, that would enable her for the general election to position herself as not the most liberal Democrat. Republicans would try to paint her that way, but she could do the kind of Clintonian triangulation that hardcore Democrats don't really like. She'd say, look, I'm not a Republican, but I'm not as far off off on the extreme as Bernie Sanders is either. That could help her in a general election.
Mm-hmm. Chris, I think you've been looking at some of Hillary Clinton's latest poll numbers, some worrying signs for the Clinton campaign. What have you been looking at there?
Well, potentially. I mean, you know, at a very general level, she still is the overwhelming favorite among Democrats and Democratic primary or caucus goers. She's still at about 60% among Democrats, with Joe Biden at 14% and 10% for Bernie Sanders. This comes from the latest CNN ORC poll. But on character issues, there has been a drop in her favorability. You know, she's at 47% in terms of people feel like she cares about the same issues as her, 49% in terms of inspiring confidence, and 57% say that she's not honest or trustworthy. These have all gone down 5 to 8 percentage points since the last poll. And you know, there was a lot of concern after the Benghazi issue, the issue with emails from the State Department, and then some of the issues surrounding the Clinton Foundation. There was a question about whether or not this would actually affect her. It doesn't seem to have affected her in terms of her competition with other candidates. But it does seem to have a significant effect on how people evaluate her character and her traits. And so it may be that we get time for the caucus, or we get closer to the nomination, and people are not maybe enthusiastic about her, but they're still willing to vote for it.
Republicans are fostering an image of her as Nixonian, and in terms of, remember, old Tricky Dick. And if that image is allowed to settle into place, that could be devastating for her.
Mm-hmm. I want you to react to something that Alan Greenblatt wrote today in Politico under the headline, "Democrats are too liberal for Bill Clinton." It's not Bill's party anymore. Can Hillary make it her own? And the first line out of this, the biggest irony of the 2016 campaign is Hillary Clinton is running as the sort of liberal Bill Clinton once ran against. The Democratic Party has moved too far left to accept the former president, or at least the version of Bill Clinton that dominated Democratic politics back in the 1990s. Dennis, do you agree? And how and why has the Democratic Party moved left, if it has, in your eyes?
Well, it's a reaction to the Bush years, and it's a reaction to being marginalized to a great extent by the success of the Tea Party movement and the well-funded nature of Republican candidates in both 2010 and 2014, particularly. The Democrats can get a presidential majority to some extent, but they can't control the House or the Senate. And we see lots of things going on in the states controlled by Republicans that are moving us in a distinctly more conservative direction. So your average Democratic partisan is pushing back against that and moving the other direction. You're right. Bill Clinton was part of that group in the 1980s who responded to Ronald Reagan by forming the Democratic Leadership Council. And they argued that we're too liberal for the American public, certainly in an age of Reagan. And they tried to make the party much more centrist. But there have always been Democrats who reject that, and we're seeing them come to the fore now.
Mm-hmm. But it does, because Bill Clinton moved to the center successfully, won two terms as president, this then provides an opportunity for the GOP, do you think, Chris, if the Democratic Party is, in fact, moving left?
I'm not sure if it does. I think, when you're talking about the Electoral College map, it's still quite favorable for Democrats. If they have someone like Hillary Clinton, who is not as far left as Bernie Sanders, as Dennis was saying, the Electoral College map still sets up quite favorably for the Democratic Party. When you get sub-national or sub-presidential, then we see significant gains for Republicans, as Dennis mentioned. At the state level, Republicans are dominating in terms of state legislatures and governors and that sort of thing. But at the national level, the Electoral College map, Democrats can quite easily get to 240, 250 without a lot of effort. So it's still going to come down to a few states.
I wanted to throw this in, too. We were talking about the suspension of the Run, Warren, Run movement. Time magazine reporting that Bernie Sanders sees this now defunct Run, Warren, Run campaign as an attractive talent pool. We heard about Hillary Clinton opening up more offices in our news break there just a moment ago here in Iowa. Today, Sanders evidently has two paid staff in Iowa, according to Time magazine. His campaign plans to hire 25 to 30 organizers in Iowa by the end of the summer, in addition to a wide network of volunteers. And according to Time, many of those staff and volunteers will likely come from this Run, Warren, Run campaign. Chris Larimer with us of the University of Northern Iowa. Dennis Goldford of Drake University. It's Politics Wednesday. We wanted to talk about another one entering the race. And to do that, I guess I'm going to cue a little music and have you tell me the significance of this old, lesser-known Beatles hit.
Number nine, number nine, number nine, number nine, number nine.
Okay, a little attempt at levity there. You've probably got it, gentlemen. Three-term U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina has become the ninth and latest entrant into the GOP presidential field. He announced his candidacy Monday at his hometown of Central South Carolina. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
It is sad for me to report to you, but Barack Obama has made us less safe. Simply put, radical Islam is running wild. They have more safe havens, more money, more capability, and more weapons to strike our homeland than any time since 9/11. They are large, they are rich, they're entrenched. As president, I will make them small, poor, and on the run.
Lindsey Graham of South Carolina entering the GOP race as the ninth declared candidate. Can you sum up what he stands for, Dennis Goldford?
Well, I think the goals he just laid out are ones that most Americans and certainly all the Republican candidates would favor. But remember, he was a lawyer in the Air Force. So is he going to ride a B-1 bomber over there and sue them? I mean, he doesn't have the kind of military experience he seems to want to convey. But his focus is national security. And he was sort of one of the three amigos. He and John McCain and Joe Lieberman, very much neoconservative in foreign policy. And those are the folks who brought us the Iraq War, and a lot of liberal Democrats think they were wrong. A lot of more traditional conservative Republicans think they were wrong. They get attacked from both the right and the left. And their point of view is there's almost no problem in the world that can't in some way be solved or made better by the application of U.S. military power. And that's part of the argument that's going on in the Republican Party right now. But he represents that.
And he's representing that, he's at the opposite end of the Republican spectrum as Rand Paul, for instance.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the ironies there, though, is, you know, you look at yesterday's vote for the USA Freedom Act, it was 67 to 32. He had 99 out of 100 senators voting. Lindsey Graham was the one senator who did not take a vote on the surveillance program. And whether or not that's going to hurt him in the long run, he didn't take a stance on earlier procedural votes regarding the renewal of the Patriot Act. I think, you know, it's going to be interesting because he is so hawkish on foreign policy.
Let's talk about this other news item in politics. Yesterday, the House Republicans unveiled a spending bill that would withhold some funding for the State Department until officials cooperate with their investigation into the 2012 terrorist attacks in Benghazi, Libya. Yes, that is still around. The House Appropriations Committee, the State and Foreign Operations Bill for fiscal 2016, withholds 15% of the State Department's operational funds until, what it says, requirements related to the proper management of Freedom of Information Act and electronic communications are met, Republicans saying in a statement. This is a threat, Dennis, that the House GOP has been considering using funding as leverage to obtain these documents related to Hillary Clinton's time as the nation's top diplomat, Secretary of State. What is your read on where this controversy is now?
Well, you know, the Benghazi situation was a terrible situation. It's always bad when U.S. military and diplomatic personnel are in danger, and certainly when they lose their lives. And it was not something handled very well by the Obama administration, either as a matter of the actual specifics or in terms of how they dealt with the aftermath. But nonetheless, this has become for Republicans with Hillary Clinton what in some ways Vince Foster was for Bill Clinton in the 1990s, the advisor who committed suicide. But there were allegations that Bill Clinton had him murdered and all these strange, bizarre conspiracy theories. And there's been no smoking gun of any sort at this point, but it's a way continually to go after Hillary Clinton's competence as Secretary of State, and that's her executive experience.
Do you imagine that the Clinton campaign is concerned about Benghazi, or to what degree?
If I were on that campaign, I would certainly monitor that and keep an eye on it so that nothing really blows up out of it. But I think they have greater concerns elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the Iowa legislative session that is about to end in the days to come. Chris Larimer, you focus on state politics, the 2015 session of the Iowa legislature wrapping up, some budgetary issues, I believe, yet to be sewn up there. What are the sticking points, as you understand them, holding up this long overdue adjournment? I guess they haven't been paid for several weeks now, have they?
Yeah, a little over a month. you know, I think it's interesting that it's the K-12 education funding seems to have been a major sticking point these last few weeks. And, you know, I think if we would go back to January 12th, 13th, the first week of the session, and we were told that the legislature went into overtime, there was a question about spending on a particular issue, I think most of us would have assumed that they're in overtime trying to debate the gas tax. Mm-hmm. The gas tax was decided very early on and signed into law in March, I believe. And it's very interesting that it's taken this long on K-12 education funding.
Mm-hmm. What else do you think this session will be most remembered for in terms of achievements? That gas tax right out of the chute, an achievement, bipartisan achievement, and something that had been long sought after. What else will you remember this session for?
Well, it sounds like a tuition freeze is going in for the three public universities, so I think that will be up there. You know, Governor Branstad mentioned in his condition of the state address, he talked about, you know, the Connect Every Acre internet policy, the Bully Free Act. Those things are still on the table. I'm not sure if much is going to get done on those yet this session. But I think, it, you know, it'll still be the gas tax session, but then it will still fit into this larger picture of the Iowa legislature taking a little bit longer on, you know, K through 12 education funding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you look at the larger picture, though, one thing that strikes me is that it's not been a culture war legislative session.
No.
It's been more traditional kinds of politics, taxing and spending, budgets, education policy, things like that. Now, if Republicans were able to retake the Iowa Senate and it became a wholly Republican state government, then we might get the same-sex marriage issues, abortion issues, things like that that you see in a lot of other states where Republicans have unified control. But this has been, from the broad perspective, I think a fairly traditionally traditional kind of political legislature.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Dennis, to follow up, Iowa is somewhat immune from the hyper-partisanship, or can we get there just as well as those folks in D.C.?
Well, there are enough people in each caucus who could be hyperpartisans, so I would never say never in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we have to remember this is still a split legislature, and mm-hmm. I think we're just getting used to the fact that since 2011, things just take a little bit longer to get done because we have a Republican House and a Democratic Senate.
Well, I think back to the 2010 primary, leaving Rod Roberts aside, you know, mm-hmm. Terry Branstad would talk about abortion and same-sex marriage, and he's right for Republicans on those issues, but he didn't really want to talk about those. He wanted to talk about taxing, spending, budget, economic development, and so forth. Bob Vanderplatz would talk about taxing, spending, and so forth, but he didn't really want to. He wanted to talk about same-sex marriage and abortion and things like that, mm-hmm. and that's not what we've had in this session.
What are you looking for in the coming days on the political landscape, each of you? Are there mile markers coming up that you're eagerly anticipating, Dennis?
Well, I'm looking forward to the Ernst event that maybe wants to be her version of Tom Harkin's steak fry. If she makes that an annual event, she's certainly still considered a star among Republicans in Washington and doing very well at the state level. But the question is, of course, with this mass candidacy of among the Republicans for the presidency, how will that sort itself out, particularly as we get closer to the time for debates?
Mm-hmm. Chris?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly the Ernst event is something to look at. Looking at the state legislature, if they're able to adjourn this week, and kind of looking at some of the final budget numbers there. But then also looking at, you know, some of the moving forward, you know, Hillary Clinton has said she's going to be back in Iowa, I think, in the following week to see if there's any sort of an attempt to address what the enthusiasm that the Sanders campaign seems to have in the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Within our borders, there are certainly people in top positions in the political parties who want to have some sort of sway, some sort of say in the presidential politics taking place over here in the next few months. Are there any kingmakers we've had? In fact, Steve King will be a guest of mine for tomorrow's program, on half of the program. He has attempted that role in the past, the governor, Governor Branstad. What can a state politician really do? What levers are there? Dennis?
Well, it's a question of whether they in fact use the organizations that got them elected to work for a particular candidate. But, you know, somebody like Terry Branstad has always taken as his priority not any particular Republican candidate, but the priority of the Iowa caucus itself. So he's always defended that most fiercely and has tended to be neutral with regard to presidential candidates. And I think quite a lot of state office holders tend to be neutral, but we may well see some endorsing candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, the other big name there would be Senator Charles Grassley. And again, he tends to be neutral, and mm-hmm. Dennis knows better than I would. But I think maybe he endorsed Bob Dole in 96, and then he's kind of stayed away from the caucuses since then.
Among non-office holders, of course, Bob Vanderplatz said he personally endorsed Mike Huckabee in 08 and Rick mm-hmm. Santorum in 12. So, you know, would he make a personal endorsement? But again, that's that evangelical side of Republican politics that's always very interesting to watch.
Mm-hmm. At what point does the field get smaller instead of larger? It's still expanding, 9 to maybe 15 or more. What are the means in which it starts to deflate?
Well, the thing of interest to me, of course, is that whether it's the straw poll or the caucuses themselves, if you don't live up to expectations, that tends to hurt your ability to raise money from donors. What's interesting to me in the wake of Citizens United is the fact that you can have a sugar daddy or sugar mama now to fund your campaign the way Sheldon Adelson did for Newt Gingrich, and he kept him well past his sell-by date in that particular
sort
race.
Of artificial life support?
Right. Right. And so the interesting thing will be if there's an impact on the caucuses and beyond of that this time around.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much for joining us, Dennis Goldford and Chris Larimer. It's been a joy to have you with us this hour. We'll look forward to having you back again soon.
Always a pleasure.
Always fun.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we will talk about the White House releasing a strategy to try and protect pollinators, aiming to grow bee populations across the country in the next 10 years. As part of that plan, there's been talk of limiting pesticide use and developing products to help beekeepers combat this mite that's responsible for the colony collapse. Tomorrow, how agribusiness is trying to help. We'll hear from Jerry Hayes, who heads Monsanto's research on bees. And as I previously mentioned, Congressman Steve King of Iowa's 4th District will be my guest as well. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines, and in Cedar Falls, Tony Daner. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.